The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Bill Quinn, and I am a member of the Free Library Foundation Corporate Committee. And as you might expect, I am also a very enthusiastic supporter of the library. This evening's program is the Horace W. Goldsmith's Foundation Endowed Lecture. And it is because of the foundation's generosity that I have the privilege tonight of introducing Professor Paul Krugman to the library. Before we get started, I would ask everybody to turn off your cell phones or silence your cell phones or throw them out the window, whatever it takes. And I would also remind you that after tonight's event, there will be a book signing in the lobby just up the stairs. Professor Krugman has been described as the most important political columnist in America. He is also, without question, one of the preeminent economists in the world. He is an insightful and outspoken op-ed columnist, and he is a passionate and eloquent writer who has a remarkable gift for explaining complex issues in simple terms. The power of Professor Krugman's writing, I think, is best measured by the impact he has had on both ends of the political spectrum. On the left, he is revered, and he has been described as the Mick Jagger of political economic punditry. On the right, not so much. On the right, he is regarded as a force to be reckoned with. As one prominent right-leaning publication put it, Professor Krugman is America's most dangerous liberal pundit. I'm sure Professor Krugman regards that as quite a credential as well. I think the fact that he has had the impact that he has in both camps is testament to the tremendous impact he has had on political discourse in this country. Now let me give you some more details on his accomplishments. Mr. Krugman is currently a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, and he has authored and co-authored more than 200 books and more than 200 papers in professional journals. He received his bachelor's degree from Yale University and his PhD from MIT. In the early 1980s, he served as the senior international economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. As one of the founders of New Trade Theory, in 1991, he was awarded the American Economic Association's John Bates Clark Medal, one of the most prestigious awards in the field, given every 2 years to, quote, that American economist under the age of 40 who was adjudged to have made the most significant contribution to economic thought and knowledge, end quote. His books include The Accidental Theorist, which is a collection of essays tackling corporate downsizing and the globalization of the American economy, among other topics. He has also authored The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century, which chronicles how the boom economy and the heady optimism of the late 1990s gave way to renewed gloom as a result of, quote, incredibly bad leadership, end quote, under the Bush administration. He said that, I didn't. In the latest book, The Conscience of a Liberal, Mr. Krugman studies the past 80 years of American history. From the reforms that tamed the harsh inequality of the Gilded Age to the unraveling of that achievement and the reemergence of immense economic and political inequality since the 1970s. He seeks in his book to understand both what happened to middle-class America and what it will take to achieve a new deal. We are honored to have him here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Paul Krugman.
Well, thanks. I always feel when one piece of that, I was an economist in the Reagan administration for a year. I was down there as a technocrat, the senior domestic economist was a guy named, Larry Summers. Don't know what happened. Anyway, so it was a long time ago. The Conscience of a Liberal, the book I'm going to be talking about today, is in some ways quite different from my last book, from The Great Unraveling. The Great Unraveling, for one thing, that was a collection of columns with some additional essays, and this is a from the ground up attempt to have a long-form argument. Actually, I was deeply nervous when writing it because I wasn't sure I could have thoughts longer than 700 words anymore. But now I think I can. That one was a book about the horrors of the Bush administration. And at the time, it was very difficult to say those things that really needed to be said. This book and my talk tonight will not be Bush bashing. We'll see about the comments. Not because he doesn't deserve it, but because there's only 15 months left. We should have a little countdown clock. And the question is, where do we go from here? And to understand that, I argue, we need to understand how we got here. So a large part of the book and a large part of what I'm going to talk about now is going to be about history. And then I'll talk about why I'm actually quite upbeat about the future prospects and what it will take to get out of this mess we're in. So let me start by a theme that I come to believe, even though obviously the top issue on everybody's plate right now is the war. To understand how we got here, you actually need to think about domestic issues. I'd even argue that the war had a lot to do with, more to do with domestic politics than anything else. But in any case, the underlying domestic issues, the things that brought us to the place we are today, fundamentally have to do with the politics and economics of inequality. Let me give you the way I think about it. I think there are two great puzzles that you have to understand, that we have to resolve in order to understand how we got to where we are. The first is the puzzle of spiraling inequality. Now, I'm a baby boomer. I grew up in a middle-class society. I grew up in a society where middle management and well-paid blue-collar workers were not living lives that different, in which the rich were not all that rich. There were poor, and significant numbers, but it was not a society of vast gaps between an elite and the rest of the population. And that has changed. And there are a lot of ways you can talk about how much we've grown unequal. We are, by the numbers, actually, when people talk about a second Gilded Age, that's not exaggeration, it's not a metaphor, it's not hyperbole. By the numbers, we actually have the same distribution of income now that we had in the 1920s. We're really back in the Great Gatsby era, which is effectively just the continuation of the Gilded Age. There's no difference. If you want to put a sense of how much does that matter? I like to point to the debate that economists have over whether the living standards of the typical family have gone up since the early 1970s. And it's an elaborate debate. If you look at some of the numbers, there's a modest gain. Some of the numbers there isn't. And you can the answer to the debate is not actually important. The important thing is that we're even having a debate, that is within the realm of rational argument to say that most Americans are no better off now than they were in 1973. Now think about that. 1973, no personal computers, no internet. Fax machines are extremely expensive, large machines that only a few companies have. No barcode scanners in the supermarket. Ships are unloaded by men hauling big bags of stuff. No freight containerization. We're an enormously richer, more productive country than we were in the early 1970s, and yet we're not sure that the typical family is any better off. And, of course, the explanation for that is that all of the gains, or nearly all of the gains, have gone to a few people at the very top. So how did that happen? That's one puzzle. How could that happen? How could the broadly shared prosperity, the broadly shared growth of the post-war generation have given way to this incredible unequalizing trend since the 1970s? The second puzzle is, where's the political backlash? Why aren't people, given this increase in inequality, you would have expected that politicians, you know, where are the new human longs? Where are the people demanding that we soak the rich? Or at least you would have expected the political process to respond to some extent by raising taxes on those who were doing so well, by providing an expanded social safety net for the middle class. And, of course, that hasn't happened. In fact, our political life until just about now has been dominated by the growing power of people who want to dismantle the social safety net. Tax rates on the top. You know, back in the days when that socialist Dwight Eisenhower was running the country, the top tax rate was 91%. Now it's 35. Back in the days of middle class America, capital gains were taxed at lower rates than 91%, but rates like 30%. Now it's 15. Dividends were taxed as ordinary income. Now they're taxed like capital gains at 15. So it's become the political trends have gone all the opposite way of the way you might have expected from income distribution. These things are related. In fact, one of the principal argument of the book about the economics is that the politics comes first, that it's actually in very large part what happened was the rise of a right-wing political movement is in turn responsible for a large part of the rise in inequality, which explains why the two have moved together. To explain why I believe that, we need to go back even further to the origins of middle-class America. And, you know, to some extent, I'm just a baby boomer nostalgic about my boyhood. And I'm not going to give a brief for America in 1955 in all respects. Obviously, there was outright segregation of the South. There was sexism in a way there wasn't. But it was a middle-class society. It was a society in which people lived in the same material universe, in which prosperity was broadly shared. We thought of it, when those of us who grew up in it, as that was where advanced countries end up. You go through a gilded age during your early stages of industrialization, but you become a middle-class society when you become mature. It must have happened. We must have evolved into that very gradually. It's not true. There is no real indication of any reduction in inequality, at least not with a significant one, until the New Deal comes along. I talk in the book about the long Gilded Age. The extreme inequality persisted right through the 1920s, right into the early part of the Great Depression. The middle-class society that we have was created in a very short period of time between the mid-1930s and the end of World War II. The economic historian Claudia Golden calls it the Great Compression. And it's one of those things you don't learn about in school, but it's actually in a way as significant for American history as the Great Depression. Over a short period of time, the policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal led to much higher tax rates on the rich, Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wages, labor laws that protected union organizers, and so we went from a union movement that was around 11% of the workforce, which is about where it is today, to 35% of the workforce. All of these things empowered workers, made them increase their bargaining power, had the great effect of leveling income distribution. And also during World War II, the policies followed during the war were explicitly leveling. They were explicitly designed to reduce income differentials. And that, now you might have, if you were a simple economics 101 guy, you'd say, well, that's just temporary and supply and demand would reassert itself after the war. But in fact, the new equality that was created during the war persisted for 30 more years. New norms were created, new institutions. We created a middle-class society. How did it come apart? Well, since the late 1970s, wages have stagnated for most workers, but pulled away, and we've seen, you know, huge growth. We've seen more than doubling of incomes adjusted for inflation for the top 1% of the population, a fivefold increase for the top 0.1%. So, by the way, people always tell me, don't use that. No one knows what that means. Right now, top 1% means about $350,000 and up in income. Top 0.1%, around $1.2 million. So the huge gains have gone to people who are well above, you know, being merely middle class. How did that happen? Well, was it, you know, changing global economy, technological change? You know, no doubt there are factors. And those are the safe explanations for a lot of people. Except there's a funny thing. You don't see that increase in inequality, at least not to that extent, anywhere except the United States. Things that we take for granted as, well, it's a modern economy, and so some of those old institutions don't apply anymore. So we look at the decline of the union movement from a third of the private sector workforce being unionized to about 8% now as being, well, you know, it's a global economy and you can't. In the 1960s, Canada and the United States both had about 30% of workers in unions. Canada still has almost 30% of its workers in unions. Only the United States has seen the collapse of the union movement. How did it happen? Well, when you start to look into the story, you find out that it's because starting in the late 1970s, but especially under Ronald Reagan, employers were basically given open season for union busting. That 1 in 20 workers who voted for a union was fired illegally. The firing of the air traffic controllers gave a signal that it was okay. And so there was really a very effective crackdown by employers, primarily crucial in preventing the new sectors of the economy from becoming unionized in the way that the old ones were. So there's no inherent economic reason why, you know, General Motors was the iconic corporation of the 60s. There's no reason why the iconic corporation of the what do we call this decade? The noughties. There's no inherent reason why the iconic corporation of our time, which is Walmart, should not be unionized. But Walmart grew big in an era when union busting by employers was fair game. No other advanced country has seen comparable increases in inequality. The only thing that looks a bit like what happened in the United States is Margaret Thatcher's Britain, and that in itself is a little bit telling. The political environment turns out to be really decisive. Now, that still leaves the question: well, how did this happen? How did this? How did politicians who were essentially pro inequality get to the position of determining policy in this country? And that's a story that is really out in the open, but people sort of don't like to tell it. So, okay. There's a thing called movement conservatism. Not my name, it's their name. If you have people will say, I'm a part of the conservative movement. They'll sometimes say, I'm a movement conservative. I guess the way to summarize it is, yes, Virginia, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy, except it's quite open. It's not hidden. So if you look at the think tanks, the media organizations, the Republican Party, there are a large group of institutions which are overlapping, share a common ideology, share common goals, take care of their own. To explain how this works, I like to compare what happened to two senators who lost their election last year. One of them was a really old-fashioned Republican, Lincoln Chafee. And he got himself a one-year teaching job at Brown, I believe. The other guy you may have heard of named Rick Santorum had a cushy job waiting for him immediately at a right-wing think tank, which is where they created the new program on America's enemies for him to head. So it's you can see that there, and it's all there. There's a real sense in which the Heritage Foundation, everything from the Heritage Foundation to Fox News, is part of a self-conscious movement. I've always thought that it's a self-conscious movement that is funded. If you look at the seed money particularly, a lot of it comes from corporations eventually, but the seed money really comes from a handful of foundations. The Richard Mellon Scaife, Coors, Koch, and so on. A small group of funders supply all of them. I've always thought that the right-wing obsession, their belief that George Soros must be orchestrating everything on the left, is partly, looking for a demon, but also that's the way things work on their side. So it kind of makes sense to them. This movement, what's it about? If you actually ask what it's really about, what is the core thing that the institutions advocate, that people are expected to support? It is about economics. It is about tax cuts and cutting back on social insurance programs. The Heritage Foundation sends out fundraising letters that say, connect the dots. Never forget what we need to do is reverse the legacy of the New Deal and the Great Society. Social Security and Medicare mainly. If you look at what we like Grover Norquist, the Americans for Tax Action, essentially the enforcer on tax cut orthodoxy, and he's been very influential. But he also has, from the point of view of people like me, the endearing habit of talking about what he's up to. Somebody once said that he's kind of like a James Bond villain who explains his nefarious schemes, and so. He once said that his goal is to get America back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt and the socialists came in. So back before, not just before the New Deal, but before the progressive movement. And all right, now this should be, you would think, crank doctrine. It should be Dwight Eisenhower wrote a letter to his brother in which he talked about people who wanted to do essentially what Grover Norquist wants to do, want to get rid of Social Security and all of the things that FDR accomplished. And he said, they are a tiny minority and they are stupid, his words. But in fact, they ended up running the world. How did that happen? What happened was that they've never won elections by running on that platform. They learned to win elections by exploiting other things. These included fear of communism once, fear of terrorism now. They do include moral values, religion. But what it is, and this is the uncomfortable truth we don't like to talk about, but it's really dead obvious when you look at the history, above all, it's about race. If you just look, I can give you the voting statistics. We talk about how white men have left the Democratic Party. Here's a statistic. In 1952, of white men outside the South, 40% voted Democratic. In 2004, of white men outside the South, 39% voted Democratic. White men didn't leave the Democratic Party. Southern white men left the Democratic Party. You can explain almost the entire change in U.S. politics by the switch of the South, which came as a result of the Civil Rights Movement. There really is almost nothing to explain in the data except the fact that Southern whites started voting Republican. And it's self-conscious. It's not just that, you could try to say, that wasn't the intention. Ronald Reagan, St. Ronald, did not begin his 1980 campaign by giving a speech on tax cuts. He did not begin it by giving a speech on confronting communism. He began it by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers had been murdered, and giving a speech in favor of states' rights. It was extremely clear-cut. And, of course, previously, through the 70s, he talked about the welfare queen driving her Cadillac. And he never mentioned what color she was, but everybody understood. Of course, she never existed, but that wasn't a problem. It is really intriguing to look back. I wouldn't quite say I'm obsessed with Reagan, but I think it's very interesting to look at who he really was because it tells you the true story of what happened to America. Reagan really became a national political figure with a speech that he gave in 1964 as a report of Barry Goldwater. It's been described, I think David Broder described it as the most influential speech since William Jennings Bryan said, "You shall not crucify this country on a cross of gold." Reading that speech is startling because it's ugly. It's ugly in a way that's hard to credit. If he made fun of John F. Kennedy for having said that millions of Americans go to bed hungry each night. They were all probably on a diet, Reagan said. It's full of racial innuendo, and then it's full of a bunch of red baiting at the end. And that is the story of how it worked. You go through the political tactics, you go through the voting, I mean, and this continues right up until, George Bush the first, won the 1988 election with the Willie Horton ad. So it has been a constant throughout. Almost everything else sort of fades out, as I said, when you look at the politics. There's also the tactics, the tactics of exploiting racial fear. I'd say the two fathers of what happened to America, that would be kind of, gay marriage. Anyway, the two fathers of what happened to modern America are Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon. Nixon was not actually a conservative. He didn't govern as a conservative. If he had any discernible ideology, it was that he should be running things. But it was, but he developed the tactics. You want to read Richard? There was an amazing piece by Richard Nixon in Reader's Digest in 1967, actually written by Pat Buchanan, but under Nixon's name, about. It's called What Has Gone Wrong with America? And it was brilliantly done. It exploited all of the fears people had, the urban riots, the crime, the descent of the war, but it all circled around liberalism, civil rights. This is why it has all happened. And those tactics were adopted by people who had more of a discernible ideology. And there's a direct line. It's always remarkable to think how many, not just how many of the tactics, but how many of the people in our current right-wing scene really do come out of the Nixon administration. Don't forget that Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, was Nixon's media guru. So it comes straight along. Amazing political transformation, and with a really ugly undercurrent below it. Other things that you think might have been really important are less than you imagine. National security. Did the Democrats lose their credibility on national security because of Vietnam? Not so much, not in the years after Vietnam. There was a reinvention of the Vietnam story quite a few years afterwards. There was what I call the Ramboification where it became the stab in the back theory and so on. But that didn't happen until a number of years after the war was over and memories of what it had really been like had faded from the public. And it's not easy to find any elections that were won on national security until 2002 and 2004. So this is a happy book. And it's a happy book because I think it's over, or very nearly over. I think that movement conservatism and the things it's done to America are, well, in their last throes. Okay. Let me tell you about what I think is changing. We just had an election. Of course, the results after the election are disappointing, and I'm sure people will have questions about that. But there certainly was a pretty amazing election last year, and it was not close. People say it was close because the Democrats only have a Lieberman-thin majority in the Senate, but that's because only a third of the Senate is elected each year. If you look at the popular vote, the Democratic majority in the House is larger than the Republicans ever had. If you look at the popular vote, it was a landslide. It was a more than 8 percentage point Democratic lead. So it was a very impressive election. And people say, well, that was maybe an aberration. I don't think so. I think that 2002 and 2004 were the aberration. 2002 was run on 9/11. 2004 was run on Bush as that will defend us against gay married terrorists. And the thing about it is that even so, I mean, it was actually, that was almost classic. In 2004, Bush runs on national security and moral values and all that. And then almost immediately after the election, you know, the polls have barely closed, and he says, and now we're going to privatize Social Security. That was movement conservatism in action. You win elections by pressing people's emotional buttons, but what you're really interested in is economic policies that foster inequality. But he failed at Social Security. The public basically said, we like this program. We hate your ideas. And the 2006 election was a very big victory for the other side. And if you look underneath, you find that people's opinions in the United States have actually been trending in a liberal direction. And most important, I think, is that race is losing its effectiveness in American politics. And it's doing so really for two reasons. One is a crude reason, but very important, which is that the electorate is getting less white. We are an increasingly Hispanic and Asian electorate. And those are groups that, because they perceive the hostility of the Republican base, are at this point very strongly Democratic. And the more uplifting reason is we are really a much less racist country. It's startling to look at public opinion polls from the late 1970s, early 1980s, which don't seem that long ago to me. But the people have said amazing things. A clear majority of the public did not accept interracial marriage as something that was okay. And today it's 77% say it's fine. So we've had this enormous shift on that. You know, that used to be miscegenation was an issue that struck fear into people's hearts, and now there are very few people who feel that way anymore. Now, that's not a directly political issue, but it gives you some sense of the changing psychology of the population. And I thought that the defining moment of 2006 was Makaka. George Allen, young American of South Asian ancestry, is there, and George Allen starts insulting him with an obscure racial insult, and that's not unusual in U.S. politics. Politicians coming out with racial insults is nothing to be surprised about. What is new is that America and even Virginia will not stand for that sort of thing anymore. That it turns out that that's deadly. We're not that kind of country anymore, which means that the whole political basis by which fundamentally anti-populist and unpopular economic policies could get sold is going away. It's a very different country. And the national security thing that won two elections for the right has been, you know, they've trashed the brand on that. So it's really pretty much, at least for a while, it's over. Where do we go? What's the positive program? Healthcare start. It has to start with healthcare. It has to start with healthcare first because it's an enormous pressing need. The healthcare system we have is unraveling as we speak. Now I'm a college professor with this other job. I know the people I know are fairly well off for the most part, group of people, and yet I know a dozen people who either lack health insurance or are terrified of losing it or are staying with jobs they hate because it's the only way they can get insurance. It's something that affects Americans across the spectrum. And you can look at the numbers. Even during the best years of the economy in the last few years, the fraction of workers with health coverage has continued to decline. It's just falling apart. And we know we can do better. Every other advanced country has universal coverage. And they do it at much lower cost than we do. And they do it with systems that, in all cases, are better than the slanders would have it. And in several cases are clearly as good or better than the health care that even well-insured Americans get. So, you know, when Rudy Giuliani says, if Hillary gets her way, we'll have French health care. My God, French health care is terrific. And it's it costs about 65% of what ours does per person. The reason is our system is wildly inefficient because the private insurance industry spends huge sums of money trying to figure out who really needs health coverage so as not to give it to them. And that's something it's something we can fix. And let me say, the leading Democratic candidates for the nomination all have credible plans for universal coverage. They're not the ideal. If I could do it my way, I would have Medicare for all right away. But they, right. But all of these plans actually have a way, a route that could lead. They're all essentially the same plan. John Edwards came out with a terrific plan early this year and was essentially matched by the other leading candidates. So they're very close. And it's a route. You can see it happening. Medicare for all would take a while to pass. These plans, which do, you know, we can have a wonkish discussion about it, but these plans, which look credible and look like they would get us establish the principle of universal care, they look doable legislatively. Fast. We can imagine, we can now, I would say that we have slightly better than even odds of having a universal health care system in this country by the end of the next president's first term, which is astonishing. You know, I have to, yes. All right. No, I have to pinch myself, right? You know, 2.5 years ago, I thought we were about to lose Social Security. And now I can see universal health care as a realistic possibility. Once you've done that, okay, let me say, I totally agree with, William Crystal. During the failure of the Clinton health care plan in 93-94, Crystal wrote a memo to Republicans saying you must not, our goal is not to improve the Clinton plan, our goal is to ensure that there is no plan. Because if there is a plan, it will legitimize the role of the government in providing a stronger social safety net. It will revitalize the New Deal agenda. He said some words to that effect. And he was right. And it will, if we can do this. It will open the door politically to more things, to doing more about inequality. But healthcare is the start. So friends of mine ask, you know, Are you okay? Are you well? You spent so much of I think every thinking person, I spent a lot of the past 7 years in a funk, very depressed about the state. But I'm actually amazingly upbeat right now because I think we have a chance. There are ways it can go wrong. It will be a vicious election campaign. Oh, and I do need to tell you, New York Times rules, I'm not allowed to do endorsements. So in principle, you don't know which party I want to see win. It will be a vicious election campaign, but in some ways what worries me most is the aftermath. Because then you have the problem of, you know, if it is a Democrat in the White House, if the Democrats control Congress, will they follow through? Money is still a big issue. Corporate contributions. I wrote in the Times recently that corporate contributions are swung heavily to the Democrats, which is good news for the party, but maybe not so good news for progressives because it could distort things. During the Gilded Age, Republicans generally controlled the White House. But occasionally, during the Gilded Age proper, the Democrats only held the White House once, under Grover Cleveland. And Cleveland was actually better than the other guys for the period, but only a little bit. He was what they called at the time a Bourbon Democrat, a Democrat as in, you know, royal. He was a Democrat who was not quite so much in the pocket of business interests as the Republicans, but pretty close. And there is this question. You know, we hope to elect FDR next year. We might find out that we have, in fact, elected Grover Cleveland. So there are concerns, but wow, been down so long, it looks like up from here. It's an amazing change in the political spectrum, and I guess four years ago I came out with a book, and it was a very, you know, very dark time, and I think I and the people I talked to were all kind of looking for some kind of hope, and it turns out that America is the country that we hoped it was. And things are much better now, and I'm looking forward to the future. Thanks. All right. Yeah, I went longer than I thought. Okay, let's go.
Folks, I think a lot of you know the way this works. If you raise your hand, we'll get you a mic. Please wait for the microphone. Please keep your hand up. The other thing is we're going to have a lot of questions, I can tell already. Please keep it succinct. Right in front here.
Hi. Thank you for coming, first of all.
Thanks.
Not to deflate your optimism, but I'm very worried about the money we're spending on the Iraq war. What's going to happen when we have to pay that back?
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, little perspective. It's hugely expensive. I was actually just looking back at my original mentor in economics was a guy named William Nordhaus at Yale, and he produced in fall of 2002 an estimate which everybody thought was wildly crazy about how much the war might cost, and turned out that it's going to easily blow through his highest end estimate. But it's a big economy. The U.S. is a very large economy. Even now, the rate at which we're spending on Iraq as a share of the economy is less than half what we were spending on Vietnam. So sure, when you look at these numbers, a trillion here, a trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. By itself, that's not crippling. In fact, it's still true that Bush spent, squandered far more on tax cuts than he has on Iraq. Even this year, the revenue lost to the Bush tax cuts will be substantially more than the spending on Iraq. So you have to, and we can handle it. Now, there is a question, long answer to a short question. There is a question. If you're a progressive, you want to change things, how concerned should you be about deficit reduction? How much of a deficit hawk should you be? And I'm much less of one than I was 10 years ago because we saw what happened, right? The Democrats were all responsible and ran surpluses, and all they did was create a pot of money that those guys could squander on tax cuts and a war. So the important thing now is to get the programs in place.
Next question, also right in front here.
I also hate to deflate your optimism, but what I can't get my concerns away from our abuse of resources. And
yeah. Oh, that can turn me. That can be very yes. Actually, I can. I think I'm very optimistic for the next 15, 20 years. Environmental stuff is terrifying, and people are just not ready to talk about what we need to do. Now, it's not that hard to do. The economics of combating climate change, once you get serious about it, are much less costly, than the oil industry would have you believe. It's not trivial, but it's within the range of things you can do. But yeah, we will eventually have to have carbon taxes. We will eventually have to have serious policies, and a lot of damage will be done in the meantime. Ultimately, all of the things, the idea that. Somebody wrote this, that future generations will look back on the notion that a handful of Middle Eastern terrorists were the greatest threat facing us as absurd, crazy, when obviously the damage we're doing to the planet is overwhelmingly the most important thing.
Another question? Gentleman right here, third row.
I notice you talk about Grover Cleveland. People like Hillary Clinton. She'll be the first woman president, but the Clintons have strong ties to hedge fund managers and big money. And I think right now she's having a birthday party where it costs $1 million a plate to get in.
It's an issue. If we, a candidate who took no money from business and was pure is not going to get elected. So we need, I'm willing to make, the real question is the candidate's heart really with the program? And the problem is that's very hard to tell. And there are, some journalists, their stock and trade is giving us reads on the character of politicians, and they all told us what a nice guy George Bush was. So I'm not sure that anybody's any good at that. I do worry, Hillary's getting a lot of money. A lot of people are just, have decided to put their chips on her because they think that she is the most likely next president. And the question is, how much influence is it actually buying? Don't know. We'll find out. I will say that at least the programs that the Democrats... Oh, there's something I forgot to mention. One additional reason for optimism. There is a real progressive movement in this country in a way that there wasn't 10 years ago. It's really... You can just see it. It's not it's not as, you know, lavishly funded and as lockstep as the right-wing movement. But it is, there's a real sense of cohesion. And it does police, to some extent, Democratic politicians. I don't think that in the absence of that movement that Hillary Clinton would have come out with a universal health care plan. She would have played it cautious, but couldn't because the activists wouldn't allow it to happen. And I'm hoping that that kind of influence will persist. When Bill Clinton came to office, there was a real sense in which he did not know what he was supposed to do and in which there wasn't a movement behind him. He didn't come into office with a health care plan. Nice contrast. LBJ passed Medicare, signed it on July 30th, 1965. Bill Clinton gave his first speech on health care in September 1993. This time, if there's a Democrat in the White House, he or she will come in with a health care plan ready to start the legislative fight. And it will do that because there's a progressive movement that demands stuff. It's just much, you know, and we'll see. There is a, 43% chance that I will be bitterly disappointed by the end of 2009. But I think there's a 57% chance that we'll all be really elated.
About seven rows.
Notice right. I can add to 100 even on my feet. Anyway, sorry.
Gentleman in the blue there.
First, I want to thank you for existing. I hate it when you go on vacation. Ruins my day.
I am filing from the road, which right now, which is more than you.
I'm
imagine.
Glad to hear it. To expand on the most recent question, I want to ask about two other senators and a sociologist, Charles Schumer and hedge funds, and where is Bill Frist now, and what did C. Wright Mills mean by a power elite?
Okay. You know, when C. Wright Mills wrote about the power elite, he didn't know, he had seen nothing. I mean, that was the America of the 50s when, yeah, there was an elite, but they all, you know, a hugely exorbitant paycheck was like $100,000 a year, and it was nothing like what we have now. I have no idea where Frist is right now. Oh, okay. Sorry. I mean, we do have the student center is all endowed by his family, and that's kind of that makes things a little even the most progressive minded university president is going to have to take that into account. I lost the beginning of it. Charles Schumer. No, this is, you know, everything I know says that Schumer himself is squeaky clean. But he thinks about the campaign war chest. And so we have this really outrageous, it's an incredible tax loophole where hedge fund managers get to have most of their income taxed as capital gains. I think actually the special tax treatment of capital gains itself is a mistake. But leaving that aside, they get it, and it, of course it isn't. It's earned income. And people say, well, but it's risky, it's uncertain earned income. Well, you know, so are book royalties. It's a lot. It's about $6 billion a year of unjustified tax breaks, enough to provide insurance to about 3 million children. So it's a lot of money, and yet, now Schumer isn't saying he won't do anything about it, but he's saying, well, we'll do it as part of a broad tax reform, which is not going to happen. And he's doing it because of the campaign war chest. And that is scary. That's a demonstration. You know, I'm hoping that won't persist. And he's probably not getting as much grief as he deserves because a lot of people do want to see this election won by the Democrats regardless. But that is going to be a real problem. There is a, you know, money still talks. I'm looking right now. I'm starting to look reforms in the wake of the subprime disaster. And Barney Frank is pushing for some really serious reforms. And the mortgage industry is pouring funds in. And, you know, they may block reform there, too. So, sure, money and it's not going to go away, but hopefully we can have some countervailing influence. Money didn't... You know, even during the New Deal, a young rising politician by the name of Lyndon Johnson got a lot of his ability to be a player out of a lot of funding by a company called Brown & Root, which later became Kellogg Brown & Root. We're not looking for utopia here. We're just looking for something a lot better.
About five rows back, with his hand up.
Returning to income inequality, how do you explain that the phenomenon that a large portion of our population that's poor and middle class doesn't want a progressive income tax?
It's not clear to me that that's really true. For one thing, taxes are not a big issue in politics. They're a big issue for politicians because it's required to be a good moving conservative. But if you look at public priorities, taxes are just way down the list. They just aren't a big deal. And you can ask people. One of the things that happens in America is you ask people, are you a liberal, a moderate, or a conservative? And about twice as many say conservative as liberal. You ask them, do you want universal health insurance? Do you want a government guarantee of health insurance? More than 2-1, they say yes. You ask, would you be willing to pay higher taxes to have that be the case? And you still have a substantial majority say yes. So people, people have liberal views, but don't think they're liberals. On the tax issue, I don't think it's really true that people. I saw the polling I've seen actually says that a strong majority feels that the rich don't pay enough in taxes. So people actually are. That if they may not quite understand how the tax system works, but I think they do believe that. And it's I don't think raising taxes on the top 2% of the population is actually going to be an election losing issue for the Democrats. I just don't think it's going to work that way. There are all these things. They're still true that. And when I visit my parents' retirement community, that everybody thinks they're going to pay estate tax. And unless their condos in Florida are more lavish than I can possibly imagine, none of them are. But it's I don't think that's a real issue. The attempts to impose right-wing economic ideology on the public have actually been remarkably unsuccessful, given just how intense the pressure has been. They really have only been able to win elections by employing what. Title of one of my chapters, by employing weapons of mass distraction.
Next question. About 10 rows back in the center, the lady in the red with her hand up.
Hi, you ended your speech by saying you were concerned about the corporate influence on even the Democrats because of the amount of money that they're giving. And it seems like our world is being run by big corporations. So I wondered if you could explain a little bit about, your understanding of what effect that has on who's running the United States.
Okay. I don't actually believe it's not that simple. Big corporations have a big influence. But if you look at the, I guess we get a little bit of Bush bashing in here right now. Blackwater, take the corporate villain of the month. Blackwater was not a big corporation until it was nothing. It was a two-bit operation until through political connections and connections to the Christian right, it suddenly started getting these huge contracts in Afghanistan and Iraq. So this is actually just the individual on the make with his friends in high places. So this is not a big corporation taking over. There are big corporations that get their way, but actually to a large extent, what's been remarkable about the corporate scandals of recent years is that we're actually talking about not big corporations getting their way, we're talking about individuals getting their way often to the destruction of the corporation or to its disadvantage. On healthcare, if big corporations were actually acting in the corporate interest, much of American business would be extremely in favor of single-payer health care. In fact, the big three automakers are enthusiastic supporters of single-payer health care in Canada. Their Canadian subsidiaries are ardent defenders of the system there, saying it's terrifically important for our competitiveness. And the question is, why don't the U.S. companies say anything like that. And it's, you know, there are many theories about that. No one quite knows. But a lot of it is probably that the individual social pressure on the top executives not to break ranks with conservatism in the U.S. trumps the actual interest of the corporations they allegedly work for. So, yeah, I mean, certainly not going to say that ExxonMobil isn't a dire influence on the planet, but it's not that simple to just say we've had a corporate takeover. In some ways, I almost wish we had, because what we've had instead is a takeover by two-bit incompetence on the make.
Another question. I think we'll keep moving back, all the way in back on the aisle there. Can you keep your hand up, sir, in the blue?
Yeah.
Just to go international for a moment, I've heard it said that one of the real drivers of the world economy now is oil. As a matter of fact, one of the drivers of the Iraq War was oil, not the democratic principles and all that we heard so much about. Would you agree with that? Would you care to comment on the role that... the oil resource plays today?
Well, oil is, you know, it's terribly important. It's getting scarcer. The theorists who think that we are at or approaching the peak in world oil production are looking pretty good right now, with oil at ranging around $90 a barrel. Iraq, I don't think... Obviously, it wouldn't have been a target if there wasn't oil, if only because oil was what was supposed to make it basically a free occupation. But I don't think the Iraq War has to have been about any one thing. That's, you know, you have, if you're imagining that there is a group of people and sitting and reasoning this out very carefully, I don't think that ever happened. I think it's a mixture of things. It's everything from, I think there was a strong element to wag the dog, because they thought it would be a quick victory over a fourth-rate power, and then a victory parade. And then, they held the victory parade on the aircraft carrier, and it didn't. I once talked to a respected journalist who would kill me if I said who he was, but I asked, what do you think it was about? And he said, oh, it's all about the Oedipus complex. It's about people who, a strong contingent of people who really felt that they felt humiliated by the fact that Saddam escaped at the end of the first Gulf War and wanted to get, it's no single thing. The main thing is that they thought it was trivial. They looked at it and they said, this guy's basically got, 30-year-old tanks and only a few of them, and we can have a pushover and then claim it was a great victory. And they paid no attention to the military people who said, invading is easy, occupying is hard. And so it wasn't intended to be what it has turned out to be. But no, whenever I hear people explain, I've had people explain, it's all about global finance and the invoicing of oil in dollars as opposed to euros. And I say, aside from the fact that I don't think those arguments quite work, who is it that you think was figuring all of this out? Who of it in this administration?
Folks, we've got I see a lot of hands, but we only have time for a couple of more questions. Right here in the fifth row, fourth row.
Professor Krugman, could we go back to the beginning of your lecture, which dealt with the middle class and how they exist today as opposed to 20 years ago? Because I'm not sure that all of the statements and stories of Bush bashing, with which I don't disagree, really deal with the issue that you began which is, how is the middle class set up today? And let me suggest a different view, and I'd like you to comment on it. One, you talked briefly and for just a moment about sexism and the change of roles for women, but if you look at the roles and jobs from an economic point of view for women over the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a sea change for half the population in terms of the types of jobs available and the income levels at which those jobs are available. There's been a change of significance, I would suggest, in terms of...
Yeah, okay. I think I'm getting the point. Look, there has been. Right? One of the, if you look at the income numbers... Yeah, I think the question was how much basically the reduction in sex discrimination has led to rising... Yeah. But median family income is up 16% inflation adjusted since 1973. All of that is because of working wives. Increase in the number of working wives and to some extent an increase in their salaries. The reason it's ambiguous is, well, but that means that there's a lot less time at home, and so it's problematic. The point is that none of this has a bearing on the fact that all of the really big wage gains, you know, men's wages have actually fallen slightly in inflation adjusted terms, since the median male wage has actually fallen slightly since the early 1970s. The median woman's wage has increased substantially, although it's still lower than the male equivalent. But none of that has any bearing on the real story, which is that, these are all modest changes compared with 100%, 200%, 600% increases within the top tiers of the workforce. So the story is not, well, women have seen bigger gains than men, but the story is that CEOs have seen enormous gains compared with ordinary workers. And I always view there is this whole thing, like changing structure of the family, changing role of women in the workforce. These are important things, but they actually have almost no explanatory power over the growth of inequality.
Let's see. We will take one more, and that is all the way on the left. The lady with her hand up and the glasses about 20 rows back.
Way at the back, I think, yeah.
Hi. The Clinton administration put some really good programs in that have survived to try to deal with the economic inequity and
right.
Make sure there's been economic
strip
opportunities for
hot lights.
Folks to move up, like this Community Development Financial Institution Fund, the Earned Income Tax Credit, individual development accounts, and some other initiatives. I'm wondering what other initiatives, besides the change in the tax structure and some of the other issues you discussed, do you think will really impact on this, not only income, but asset inequality?
Okay, there's actually a whole chapter in the book. But mostly I think we're talking about more. So a much bigger earned income tax credit. We're talking about, we need a lot more in terms of aid for education, much bigger support for college students. I can go on about just how bad, you know, when you hear that young French are much less likely to be working than young Americans, and that's always portrayed as a problem. Partly it's because they're much more likely to be able to stay in school, and much less likely if they are in school to have to work because they receive much better financial support from the government. So those sorts of things and I think if you put them all together, they add up. If you look at what the Blair-Brown government in Britain, you know, we're all mad at Tony Blair over that thing, but they are a fairly serious attempt at they tried to do something to redress the growth of inequality that took place under Thatcher, and it included a lot of programs that are similar to the kinds of things that Clinton put in on a small scale because it was all he could do, but much, much bigger. And they have actually succeeded in stopping the growth of inequality and actually reducing it except at the very top tier, which is driven by all of the tax exiles moving to London. So I don't think we need to talk about qualitatively enormously different programs. We need to talk about U.S. funding for all kinds of programs that diminish inequality is tiny compared with any other advanced country. It's half what's spent in Canada. It's a third what's spent in Britain. It's a quarter what's spent in France. It's a sixth what's spent in Scandinavia. So not radical changes in how we do it, but actually enough to make a difference.
Thank you, Paul Krugman.
Thank you.
There's more water upstairs.
Yeah.
Good, that was great.
All right, oh, there's more here.
So. Yeah. Well, there's more upstairs.
Okay. Great, so what do we do?
Let's just jump right up.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.